afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. All right, the first case on our afternoon docket is 50598, Saylor versus Arcata. Are we ready to proceed? All right, Mr. Wall, come on up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, please report. Michael Wall, on behalf of the appellants Bulger Cab Incorporated and Deluxe, doing business as Deluxe Taxi Cab, and their driver Jack Saylor, who was involved in an accident, which kind of underlies this case, but is really tangential in a way to the case. Initially, my client would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to appear here today and to argue these issues. As I see it, Your Honor, Your Honors, there really aren't any factual issues. There certainly, as far as what happened, there's no dispute as to what happened in this case. And I believe that there are two legal issues that Your Honors are called upon, the court is called upon to decide in this appeal. And I think they're separate legal issues, although they sometimes become combined, or we talk about them in a combined way. We have two claims that were raised below, contribution and implied indemnity. And you always hear those together, contribution and indemnity. I've often seen it pleaded as a single cause of action, contribution and indemnity. But actually, they're not the same cause of action. And they have different elements. And although there's some overlap with respect to the legal ideas,
but here, don't you have successive tortfeasors rather than joint tortfeasors?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. We have successive tortfeasors, not joint tortfeasors in the sense, in any sense. They are successive tortfeasors. And the district court treated this as though it was a medical malpractice claim and dismissed both the contribution claim and the indemnity claim on the same basis, applying the statute of limitation that applies to a medical malpractice claim. I believe that that statute doesn't apply and that the decision of the district court was therefore in error for two reasons. The statute of limitations for a contribution claim is set forth by statute, and that's the statute that should have been applied. And as far as indemnity or implied indemnity is concerned, this court has not yet directly addressed that question as to what the statute of limitation should be. Implied indemnity is a court-created remedy. It's an equitable remedy, and it addresses the situation where you have a primary or active tortfeasor and a secondary passive tortfeasor, and where both of them are responsible for the same damages or potential damages. In this case, what we have is exactly that kind of a case. So when we talk about which statute of limitations should be applied, we need to look at what the case is about in order to know what the legislature would have intended and what as this court as a policy would intend, especially with respect to indemnity, a remedy that was created by the court. With respect to the wrongful death, the negligence of my clients was secondary or passive at best. There wasn't any. And with respect to the doctors, it was primary. They committed the acts which resulted in the death. Now, there's a dispute as to whether or not that was malpractice or not malpractice, but here today, we pleaded malpractice, and it was dismissed on statute of limitations grounds. And so those well-pleaded facts should be accepted as true. So what we have here is we were in an automobile accident. There are some facts that about who was responsible for that accident, the other driver, and all of that. But that's really irrelevant. We were in that accident, and our liability, if any, is based upon that accident. And the question here is whether or not the damages that flowed come from that our client is responsible for those. We all know that it's a foreseeable consequence. The doctors, how the doctors will treat, even if it's malpractice, that's a foreseeable consequence. And so my client becomes responsible for the damages, liable for the damages, but we didn't know and couldn't have known that the damages were completely unrelated. If you look at the facts of this case, she was 80 years old and she was injured, the plaintiff, and she was treated and then she was released. Then she had a heart attack. It was within 2 weeks. We didn't know, and it wasn't pleaded in such a way for my clients to know that the real cause of death was not the accident. Whether you can relate it or not is another question, but there was this medical negligence. At least we believe there was this medical negligence, and there's no doubt about the facts. After Dr. Arcata's deposition, they made a choice to allow the patient to die on the table because the family did not want to have anything done that would have been life-saving or out of the ordinary, but that, we believe, was below the standard of care in a situation where they should have done a routine procedure, and that would have resulted in there not having been a death. Applying to this kind of a claim, indemnity, a medical malpractice statute of limitations, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. The legislature has set up the malpractice statute of limitations, and it's a very short statute of limitations, and because of that, it should be viewed carefully by this court. It shouldn't apply where it wasn't intended to apply. The medical malpractice statute of limitation applies to an action for injury or death. And then it talks about the injury or death of the plaintiff. We don't have an action for injury or death. We have an action for indemnity, which, just because it's related to the action for injury or death, doesn't make it into an action for injury or death. The problem with applying the medical malpractice statute of limitation to our facts is that it's almost impossible to apply in any reasonable way to a third party. One could imagine all kinds of different situations where the statute of limitation, whatever it is, because we don't, if it's tied to an underlying action that isn't before the court or to some underlying act, it's almost impossible to know when that statute of limitations is run. In the medical malpractice situation, you could easily have a claim brought against the tortfeasor, and after the statute of limitations is arguably run completely, and they wouldn't have any way of knowing that. So it becomes, this court has not addressed what the statute of limitations should be. I suggest that the statute of limitations should be something similar to what there would be in a contribution case, because this is far more like a contribution action than it is like a medical malpractice action. But even if we did decide, if we attempted to look at the medical malpractice statute of limitations, it's very difficult to apply that in this case, because the question then becomes, when did my clients, the cab company and their driver, learn of the claim? And what was their duty of inquiry, and when was it triggered? In this case, they did get a few medical records that were produced early on, but they had no reason to know or to believe or to even suspect that those medical records showed some kind of malpractice. Reading those records, number one, we didn't get that many records. Number two, if you read them, it's very, very difficult to know what is in there. And what the doctors have done is they've taken number 18 out of a list of 19 things, which was called a secondary diagnosis. It wasn't even a primary diagnosis, and they've expanded it out to what the letters stand for, which we could do, and it says that there was a problem during the angioplasty. That can happen. That's a regular consequence of having a medical procedure done. So that doesn't, the fact that there was a problem, that doesn't put anybody on notice that that problem may have been malpractice. So in order to say that because we had those medical records in our possession, we were at that point on inquiry notice that there was a medical malpractice claim, puts the burden in every garden variety automobile accident case and every other personal injury case, that somebody gets some records, they've got to go out and hire a doctor to look at that and say, is there a possibility that there's medical malpractice here? I don't believe that the law, when it requires reasonable inquiry, that it actually means that it would impose that kind of an obligation on a third party. Because the medical malpractice statute, it doesn't speak to a third party, it speaks to the patient. Even our case law, which addresses that, says the patient, when the patient has information, that is what triggers it. If the patient knows that they've been injured, the patient knows that they've been treated, they know what the circumstances are, And so it makes sense.
But what other statute would be more specifically applicable? And I mean, could you apply 11190? Could you apply the catch-all statute of limitations? What other statute is out there that's more appropriate than linking it to the medical malpractice statute of limitations?
That's the question that is to this, given to this court to identify, and I think it would be either a catch-all or it would have to be some statute of limitations that is similar to the statute of limitations in contribution, which recognizes statutorily that you don't know what that contribution amount is until later, and so it doesn't make any sense to start the statute running. In any event, the statute should be not the medical malpractice statute, and it should be a statute that, or a period of time that takes into consideration what when a third party is brought into the action and when they have actual knowledge and when they are on inquiry. In this case, they weren't on inquiry until they had the deposition of Dr. Arcata, because before that, they had no way of knowing and no reason to believe that there had been medical negligence.
Right, but the medical statute of limitations has an inquiry notice one, but it also has an outside time limit of 3 or 4 years, depending whether it's before or after 2002. So they were trying to set an outside time limit. After 3 years, it's over.
Yeah, they were trying to set an outside time limit. We were inside that outside time limit. The question is, if the time limit is on the based upon having found out about the claim, a party should have a reasonable opportunity to find out about the claim before that time starts to run. And under the circumstances of this case, that's at least a question of fact as to when my clients had some knowledge as to when the time began to run, or should have begun to run. And all we had was a few medical documents, an accident with a death that followed very shortly thereafter, and no reason to suspect that the real cause of the death was medical negligence. It really wasn't the accident. In this case, she wasn't even in the hospital because of the accident. She was in the hospital because of a heart attack, which was apparently unrelated. And so within 5 months of finding out about the medical problem, we were able to get our ducks in a row, we got our doctors online, and filed our complaint. To suggest that that was too late, we think, is a misapplication of the wrong statute of limitations. Beyond that, we also had the contribution claim, where the statute is 1 year after there's a judgment. And the argument below was that we couldn't combine the contribution claim into the ongoing action. That was their argument. Now, on appeal, they say, oh, yeah, we could combine it, and we did, and it fell with our other claim, which they say is a medical malpractice claim.
Did you want to reserve any time?
Yeah, I'm looking at this, and I wanted to reserve 2 minutes, so I got like 30 seconds.
Okay, go ahead.
Just to finish that thought really quickly, then I'll reserve the time. The contribution claim could be brought. It was brought. We want to go back and have it in the same action. We're not trying to get two bites at the apple. The contribution statute has its own specific statute of limitations, and that should have been applied. And if you apply that in this case, we certainly were not.
Isn't there an argument that the contribution is premature, though?
I'm sorry?
Isn't there an argument that contribution is premature at this time?
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor. It's not premature because you can always bring contribution in the action and then work it to a judgment. It happens in thousands of cases all of the time. And that's just a misreading of the statute. They're reading the part of the statute that applies to when there is no judgment and no action.
But so, isn't contribution traditionally between joint tortfeasors as opposed to successive tortfeasors?
The contribution statute says when two tortfeasors, it doesn't say joint tortfeasors, it says two tortfeasors, are responsible for the same injury or death.
And isn't that traditionally viewed as joint tortfeasors, though, or...
I don't know how it's reviewed. I didn't find any case law or statutory law that would limit it to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sherman Mayer for Dr. Nancy Donahue. Cheryl Horner's here for Dr. Boddy and Robert McBride for Dr. Arcata. I'll be arguing maybe with the assistance of Ms. Horner. I'll try to be very brief to get to the heart of the issues, but Ms. Ventimiglia was in an automobile accident on October 5, 2004, where she injured her cervical spine. Several weeks later, she suffered an unrelated MI, heart attack. On October 19th, she underwent a cardiac catheterization procedure during which an accidental perforation of the artery occurred. She bled out. The family didn't want any emergent treatment, and she passed away. The family itself did not sue the physicians, did not criticize the physicians, and in fact placed a DNR, do not resuscitate order, on Mrs. Ventimiglia. There were two, the family did sue the other driver of the other car and Deluxe Cab for the accident. The other driver settled, and Deluxe Cab defended. Later, Deluxe Cab brought a third-party complaint naming these three doctors as third-party defendants. When they brought their third-party complaint, the events I've just discussed occurred in December of 04 and in 05. When they brought their third-party complaint in May of 07, they brought it as a medical malpractice case. I say that first counsel has just said to the court, here today we pleaded malpractice. Paragraphs 3 and 5 of their complaint state the acts and omissions constitute medical malpractice, and such medical malpractice caused Mrs. Ventimiglia's death. That's pled in their complaint. They attached three affidavits to their complaint to comply with NRS 418.071, the affidavit expert requirement, for a medical malpractice case. They had three separate medical doctor affidavits attached to the complaint, arguing medical malpractice, arguing the standard of care. The only tort theory pled in the complaint was medical malpractice. To bring a claim for contribution or indemnity, I've listened to what the court said about a successor tortfeasor and would agree that is traditionally how it's applied. But even taking that argument aside, you have to have an underlying tort to support a claim for a contribution and indemnity. Either the underlying tort, the only underlying tort in this case, is medical malpractice. That's what how the case was pled. Judge Bell then, when he found the medical malpractice case was untimely, dismissed properly the whole case because the contribution indemnity claims were derivative of the medical malpractice claim, and when that failed, so then would the contribution indemnity claims, which were derivative of medical malpractice. I know that you have the sequence, and I've got limited time, so I'll just try to rush through it, but the auto accident, October 504, the cardiac catheterization procedure where the perforation occurred was October 1904. Dr. Arcata charted that day in her report called Cardiovascular Invasive Procedure that she had advised the family of what had occurred, of the accident and of the death, and the DNR was charted that day. The family only chose to bring an action against the cab company in which she was riding and the other driver. They amended their complaint in February of 05, and Deluxe answered the complaint in March of 05. The reason I'm giving you these facts is because the other driver, not Deluxe Cab, settled with the plaintiffs for the car accident and moved for determination of good faith settlement. Deluxe Cab opposed that settlement, and in their opposition to the motion for determination of good faith settlement, they stated in their opposition, and their opposition was dated April 1, 2005, that Mrs. Ventimiglia died when she was catheterized and her artery was accidentally perforated. That's in their opposition, written on April 1, 2005. They actually say that, opposing the settlement of the other driver. They also...
So you're saying that's the date they were on notice of...
We're beyond inquiry notice. We're on absolute notice. Acknowledged notice. Moreover, on May 26, 05, as part of the litigation process, Deluxe produced a 16.1 filing of witnesses and exhibits. In doing that, they produced the UMC medical records. On the first page of the medical record, it says accidental perforation of an artery per the cath. They also listed in their list of witnesses on May 26, 2005, Drs. Donahoe, Arcata, and Body as potential witnesses back in May of 2005. The mention of the accidental cut hemorrhage with the heart cath is on page 1 of the UMC records typed. So we have inquiry notice, reasonable notice, and actual notice of this accident and the cause of death. Judge Bell, in applying that to these facts, looked at the NRS 41A-097-2, and he looked at the discovery rule. We weren't applying the statute of repose. We were applying the one-year discovery statute. And the statute says you have 1 year from the time that you knew or reasonably should have known or should have discovered the injury. Under the Massey case, which we've cited, injury has been defined by this court to mean legal injury. Legal injury has been defined by this court to mean either actual or presumptive. In Judge Bell's order, he relied on Massey almost exclusively, which is the seminal case. And he says that in his actual order, it said that he found facts which would put a reasonable person on inquiry notice of his possible cause of action. Judge Bell pointed out that Massey stated that the focus to find inquiry notice, we actually have actual notice here, but to find inquiry notice, the focus is on the patient's access to the facts rather than on her discovery of legal theories. You don't have to wait for a plaintiff to wait around to discover theories. If they have the facts in their hands and they have access to them, the inquiry notice begins.
How do you harmonize NRS 17.2853, which is the one-year contribution claim after a judgment's rendered, and 41A-097-2? And I heard Mr. Wall saying, he's saying the injury has to be a medical injury and it only applies to plaintiffs, and I'm not sure I agree with that, but if you're saying, in essence, that 41A-097's limitation period trumps the one-year statute in 17.285. Is that right?
No. What we're saying, I appreciate the question. What we're saying is this. 41A-097 gives you a one-year discovery statute of limitations rule, discovery rule. The contribution statute gives you 1 year after the time, after verdict, after you think you have an inequitable judgment rendered against you. In reading the two in pari materia to try to make them apply, you can always apply Rule 14A to accelerate a contribution or indemnity action.
It's permissive, but
you may accelerate. You may be able to do that. And you say, how do I find? Well, you have a 1 year statute if it's medical malpractice, but they being Deluxe Cab wouldn't have had even an injury. They would have no standing until they suffered a judgment.
Or paid more than their share.
And they hadn't done either. So the only way they could bring this action is to permissively accelerate under 14A into the main cause of action, which is what they did.
Okay, so you're not arguing that they couldn't have brought one a year after sustaining a judgment?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm agreeing they could have brought it 1 year, but they elected to accelerate. And under the law of the Heck case that we cited in the court that Judge Pro wrote, there's good reason to do that, and it is a common practice to avoid inconsistent judgments, to have it all litigated at one time. I think that they could have brought an action 1 year after judgment if it was an inequitable judgment, but they didn't. They chose to bring it now. When you do use that permissive acceleration, the defense doesn't waive its right to defend the case because you've accelerated. Any defenses that we can bring, we can bring. And one of them is the statute of limitations, and we brought it. When they weighed that, they had to weigh the defenses that would be come forward to them when they accelerated. And the statute of limitations was in this case, the first motion that was filed and the one that was granted. So we don't argue they could accelerate, and we don't argue they could have brought it 1 year after a judgment, but we also find that having brought it as a malpractice claim, accelerating it, they're subject to the defenses that are used in a malpractice case, which is what happened in this case. Judge Bell so ruled. Judge Kadish denied their motion for rehearing. I do want to, I guess I have 5 minutes here. I do want to touch on the indemnity issue just briefly. They only pled in their complaint indemnity, not implied indemnity. And I understand that's kind of a nitpicky type of a thing, but they only pled indemnity, not implied indemnity. But even if this court were to somehow allow them to morph their indemnity claim to be an implied or equitable indemnity claim, there still, under any of the case law of this state, must be a pre-existing legal relationship between the plaintiffs and the third-party plaintiffs and the third-party defendants. In Doctors Company versus Vinson, it's a 120 Nevada 644 case, this court stated, in order for one tortfeasor to be in a position of secondary responsibility vis-a-vis another, they must be entitled and thus be entitled to indemnification, there must be a pre-existing legal relationship between them, which we don't have here, or some duty on the party of the primary tortfeasor to protect the secondary tortfeasor. We don't have that either. The doctors have no duty to deluxe taxi cab. Under the most tortured analysis, there would be no contractual or legal relationship or pre-existing relationship or protective duty for the doctors to deluxe taxi cab. Actually, they don't have standing for an equitable indemnity claim at all. But we didn't have to reach that because equitable indemnity, like contribution, must be based on an underlying tort. It doesn't stand alone. There has to be a tort that supports the claim. The tort they used here was medical malpractice. They accelerated it, brought the claim. Judge Bell looked at it, found they had inquiry notice, and dismissed it under NRS 41.8.0972 as being untimely. It wasn't just untimely. It was more than a year untimely. They didn't miss by a couple of days. They had actual notice in April of 05 and didn't file until May of 07. And the one-year discovery rule is 1 year. So it's actually 2 years and a month that they filed. So they missed it a lot. So hence, Judge Bell was correct, we believe, in finding that if there is no underlying medical malpractice case, which is how this case was framed, with three affidavits and how it was pled, there can be no contribution or indemnity claims. They have to, by necessity, fail because they are derivatively based on the malpractice case. And so he dismissed, and here we are. Glad the court has any other questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Were you splitting your time with Ms. Horner?
I think Mr. Mayor got through the issue.
Okay.
I rushed faster than I thought I...
Thank you.
Counsel, could you begin with the position they've taken if there's no underlying claim?
Yes, Your Honor, that's where I was planning to begin. They say that there has to be an underlying claim for indemnity or contribution. That's simply wrong. Indemnity and contribution are separate causes of action. When a plaintiff sues two defendants and they sue each other for contribution and indemnity, there's no underlying claim other than the plaintiff's claim. The fact that there has to have been some basis for each of them to be charged as a tortfeasor doesn't make the claim is derivative, or that you have to have that underlying claim. It's still a claim for indemnity or contribution.
How do you deal with the representation, though, that basically your party's position is based on medical malpractice? That's how it was pled, based on his representation.
It was the malpractice or the medical negligence is an underlying fact that was pleaded, but the causes of action that were pleaded were not medical malpractice. It was indemnity and contribution. The other claims that he talked about that we didn't have standing are not before this court because the district court never reached them, but they're without merit. I've only got a few seconds, so I can't go into that. But he said it right at the beginning. This is at the heart of the issue. It was an unrelated heart attack, and the family did not sue the doctors. They sued for the accident, he said. They didn't sue for the accident, Your Honors. They sued for wrongful death.
Thank you, counsel. Very interesting case you put before us, and we appreciate your good briefing and your arguments today, so the matter will stand submitted.